This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by Irving C. Salzberg Production Limited and Salzberg Art Films, Oil, Real Estate, Banking, and Prostitution Incorporated, a co-production.
Oh, who are you? You're not a wet writer? Well, you're fired!
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
I'm well. How are you on this fine November day?
Oh, it's nice and not cold here I am. I love it.
We're closing in on Thanksgiving in the States. It's a late Thanksgiving this year. Hopefully, some people will download this episode and tuck it away on their respective MP3 players so they can listen to our sultry tones and avoid their families over the next couple of days.
In which episode are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about episode 6, which has the unofficial title of It's the Arts. This is one of the first few episodes that specifically didn't have a subtitle. Apparently there was some mild irritation. We mentioned this a little bit last week that the BBC and specifically the Light Entertainment Division under Mills felt that the subtitles were confusing. And so this is technically untitled, but for the purposes of VHS and DVD and home video releases, it's useful to give episodes titles for distinguishing between which volume and which episode you're purchasing. So It's the Arts has ended up being the unofficial official title of the episode.
Interesting. Do you have any notable points that you want to bring up at the top of the podcast?
I think that a couple of things will come up as we go through it. But in general, I will say that this episode is interesting to me in how much of it is dialogue-free. We have a largely silent, or I should say largely dialogue-less film at the heart of it, The Dull Life of the City Stockbroker. We have some lengthy animations and film bits, The Scotsman on a Horse. In general, there's actually a rather large amount of lack of verbal jokes in this episode. And if you were to just drop a needle, which we will do later for the Python Minute, in a given moment of the episode, I think you would probably find a stretch of just sound editing and laughter without any particularly heavy writerly verbal lines from the six.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because there was a long span of time when I was in college. This is before you had portable video, and it's also before DVDs really were a thing. So to have a lot of this Monty Python be really accessible to me, I just cut the audio from the VHS cassettes. So I had audio tapes of the VHS presentation of the Flying Circus. So a lot of the shows that I absorbed were just the audio alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching things later on in life, I sort of got more visual jokes that were there. And this episode in particular, a lot of the visual stuff I didn't get until a bit later on in life.
Because your primary repeat exposure was just the audio track.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm not dissimilar. I spent a reasonable amount of time in high school and college driving around and taking clips from films, having my VCR hooked up to my dual tape deck and ripping the audio. Ripping is what we'd call it now in a post-CD world. But yeah, extracting and re-recording the audio in order to listen to quotes from movies and monologues and dialogues and sections of soundtracks that weren't commercially available. So I also had a very similar experience to you in terms of absorbing a lot of media through listening to it on long drives instead of rewatching it. Because when you rewatch something, you have to pay attention with your whole self. You need to, both your eyes and your ears. Well, I mean, I do. Some people are accustomed to having a television on in the background and doing other things, but I find that to be a very distracting experience where I need to focus on the shining light box in the corner.
Yeah, let me introduce you to younger generations, Ben. So I cannot, if the TV's on, I can't even have a conversation with anyone. I have to physically turn myself away and make a conscious choice to not listen to things, especially if it's something that I don't even have to like it. I just have to be aware of it. I just cannot be within visual range. I just get so distracted.
Yeah.
But my wife, who's a little bit younger than me, she needs to have that on in the background for the noise and the visual for some reason. I don't really understand why or how, but that's just what happens. We just might be of the generation where having visual distraction is so distracting that you can't do anything else.
What do you mean?
But your ears, if you're just listening to things, you can do, you can drive, you can fold clothes, you can do all kinds of things that are useful, but not when you're watching something.
I want your opinion of my idea.
I feel like we've talked a little bit about how podcasting is reclaiming a certain amount of that niche for certain people. I don't have any good stats as to the age of a podcast audience and whether or not there are certain genres like the true crime genre of podcasting that might tend towards a certain gender or a certain age group. But I do wonder if some of that experience of being able to do the dishes or fold laundry and therefore a podcast is a useful thing might fall with people more similar to our age range because they're similarly inclined in terms of their neural processing and what they're able to distract themselves with. Whereas my younger brother posted a photograph of himself watching the big game on Sunday, and he had his laptop in front of his television and then his phone and his tablet, all with different versions of the screens and the live feed of his fantasy football league and the other league. And, you know, he didn't enjoy the experience unless it was fragmented into all those different versions of the experience.
Laura, any questions?
I don't know, one screen and, you know, I'm happy with two-channel stereo.
Well, on the other hand, the amount of tabs that I have open in order to refer to various things over this podcast, I really could use a swordfish-esque array of monitors on an arc in front of me. So, speaking of swordfish, a reference that nobody's used in quite some time, not even Hugh Jackman himself.
We're not about to allow this sort of smut to be shown on screen.
You started off by talking about the captions that appeared at the beginning. Do we want to just go through the introduction of the show? Do we want to start off by talking about your top three sketches?
We start with an interview.
Some things I want to say just about the show structure and things that kind of jumped out at me, which were new. So going on the captions.
Yes.
There's a lot of reading in this episode. There's actually two things I want to talk about before launching into the three favorite sketches. First is the large number of women in this episode, and only a small number of them, in fact, only three of them get a credit in IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
And I counted up to probably more north of seven. These are people who have no lines, but do have a part to play in some of the sketches.
I can think of three off the top of my head. So we've got three prominent ones in The Dull Life of a City Stockbroker. We've got the stockbroker's wife, who's played by Miss Eddie Mae Scandrett. Do I have that name right?
Eddie Mae Scandrett. That's what I have too.
Yep. And then there's the woman making out in the office at the end of the sketch, who could be the same actress because her face isn't shown. And then there's the topless store clerk in the middle of the episode.
That is correct. The topless store clerk is a lady by the name of Sheila Sands, who has a number of IMDb credits. Stripper, striptease, strip artist, and something called art sex girl. So she really kind of leaned pretty heavily into that. I think I remember somewhere that they met her at a strip club.
Hmm.
One of the Pythons or one of the producers met her at a strip club and just realized that, we need a person willing to go nude on television. And I think she was all too happy to fill the role.
If I may cut in on you.
Which is interesting to note is it's generally not a BBC policy to allow full frontal nudity on family programming, but due to the lateness of the show, they could sort of bend the rules a little bit. Also interesting to note that this show is the only one in the first series that broadcast before 10 p.m. So it's actually the earliest episode to ever go on in the first season.
Interesting.
There might be another one that show breasts, but this is the one which is everyone seems to remember and is the earliest broadcast one. In fact, if you listen to Trey Parker and Matt Stone, they will talk about this moment as the defining moment for them as why they like Monty Python.
There's a particular sketch of a BBC announcer who's really scared and embarrassed because he's failed in the past, and everybody's encouraging him to do the transitional links before the next programming. Mm-hmm. And when they then cut to after he's done the voiceover, you have a real life BBC newsreader silently reading the news while the soundtrack of the celebrations of everybody complimenting the Lynx Man continues over his news report. It's a wonderful little piece of weirdness that I've always enjoyed. One of the frames behind him of the various montage of stories that he's talking about also includes a shot of bare breasts in that. And I think that was the first time that I noticed, oh my God, they're not censoring this material on television. That's kind of fascinating. Not in a teenage sexual awakening way, which is sort of how you seem to be describing the South Park boys talking about it.
Well, as I mentioned already, I did a lot of consumption of Python through audio, and breasts do not translate to audio well at all. So just I want to go back to this list of ladies. So Sheila Sands was the topless news seller. I would also put in the dead secretary, the one who has been stabbed in the back, who's hunched over the typewriter. Not because playing dead is a nonsense craft, because it's actually very hard when you're in front of a studio audience and you only have so many takes you can do to remain totally motionless. I know she's on camera for a short bit, but I don't even know who it is, but I'm going to give her a thumbs up. We have the lady at the bus stop. The stockbroker's life. I'm not sure if it's the same Eddie Mae Scandrett. I really can't tell. Then we have in the theater sketch, which I'm sure we'll touch on, a lady by the name of Constance Carling, who it seems based upon her profile that she was an actor who was trying to get whatever kind of work she could get. I mean, a lot of it is just background and extra work. But she does have a pretty prolific IMDb listing, and she was acting well into the early 2000s.
Huh.
But that's an interesting sketch only because, not because of the content, but because basically the actors went out into the BBC audience. There's no way you could get a huge number of extras on a stage. Rather, you just turn the camera around and film people as if they were the stage. So the lady is the person who is sitting next to Eric Idle, who is dressed, I should say, tastelessly as a Native American. But she is there basically because she can't draw too much attention to herself, which a normal person in the audience probably would. And in fact, they do, because they're sitting just behind Idle, kind of gawking at him the whole time.
There are two women that are noticeable in that sketch, and I was wondering which one you were talking about. The woman who's in the row immediately behind Chapman and Idle. At first, the camera doesn't really notice her based on its angle and its position. But after Chapman and Idle stand up, because Idle's character is gesturing to the skies in his huge, dramatic, false Native American storytelling manner.
Do you go to the theater a lot?
When moon high over prairie, when wolf howl over mountain.
Once they sit back down, the woman in the row behind them is very prominently highlighted. She has amazing eyes, and you're right. She's torn between staring ahead, waiting for the scene, and staring deeply at the back of Idol's head, really just fascinated with him. And she's very hard not to notice once you start seeing that she's trying to be in character but really can't stop staring at his wig and his body paint. Or perhaps that's just me projecting at what I would be staring at if I were in that scene. Sitting next to Idol is a blonde woman who he nearly kills with his quiver of arrows when he stands up.
She is Constance Carling. You can see that, yes, she almost gets decapitated by his bow and arrow, has her eye almost gouged out. She's holding chocolates for him that he takes right at the end.
Okay,
and
yeah.
She doesn't look at him when he walks in, so she's doing her best to be part of the reality, such as it is. So she's the one they had to pay to be there so that she wouldn't draw too much of a scene. I'm like, oh my God, I'm on camera.
Okay.
Like all the people behind them clearly were doing that.
Yeah, well, she's definitely a pro in that she does not blink or flinch when that quiver swings down towards her face. And Idol does a good job of also not looking scared or embarrassed, but grabs it and sort of tucks it back towards his body when he sits down, which means there probably is a take where she got whammed, because he is aware that of the pitfalls of it. You can tell based on his body language that he's trying not to let that happen when he sits back down. I didn't notice that she's holding the chocolates. That's a good observation.
Lastly on the list is the, I don't know who she is, but she plays the Scottish bride in Scotsman and a Horse. There are a number of other women and men kind of in the church, but she's there front and center.
Once again, referring to my invaluable resource of Daryl Larson's complete, thoroughly unillustrated, absolutely unauthorized guide to possibly all the references. In the Scotsman on a Horse entry, he lists a number of people that appear in the sketch, including the stunt rider, whose name is Harry Woodley.
Hmm.
The bride is played by a woman named Bernardine or Bernadette Barry. And he also lists credits for the priest and one or two of the other guests who have also gone on to appear in Doctor Who and Jane Austen's Emma and Some Mothers Do Avum, a long-running sitcom, and were generally considered to be BBC drama and light entertainment mainstays for quite some time.
The interesting thing about all of these women is that none of them are Carol Cleveland.
Right.
As the seventh Python, she is either not asked or she turns down because none of them are speaking parts.
Mm.
Maybe that just like the gig wasn't good enough for her. I don't know. Whenever they have a woman, typically people think of Carol Cleveland as the go-to, and just not in this episode.
It's a great observation. And I agree with you that as a talented comedian, it's well within her rights to say, I can do a little bit more than just be a silent woman in your sketches. Call me back when you need me to deliver some lines. There's an interesting future callback, whatever that term might be. In the Vox Populi after the mobster sketch, you have bank robbers and then a vicar with a poor box.
I agree. I mean, if you're going to go straight, you might as well be a vicar or something.
A stockbroker and a posh woman. And then you have two judges who walk by and say,
we like dressing up, yes.
And Eric Idle's judge does a marvelous little kiss at the camera, very subtle, before walking off screen. It's almost an exact presaging of the sketch that will appear in episode 21 of the two judges undressing in chambers and being all camp about the way in which they were able to maintain the ideal of jurisprudence in the box and then relax once they're no longer on duty.
That sort of future callback, if you want to call it that, is also with the joke is in the credits idea. This episode has everybody in the sketches, everybody in the entire episode, including the production team, end their name with Burr.
Yep.
Because Irving C. Salzberg of the 20th Century Vol Productions is so egomaniacal that everyone has to have that name.
Produced by Irving C. Salzberg Jr. and Irving C. Salzberg.
So it kind of makes you watch the credits a little bit more closely than you normally would. That is something which is not so much in the end credits, but the beginning credits of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a bit that they will come to use later on to great effect.
We've talked a little bit about the Red Indian appearance in the theater sketch. Irving Salzberg was our official non-spawn sponsor for the episode, and the Berg gets tacked on to the end of everybody's name. It's easy to reach the conclusion that this could be, because of that suffix, a specific poke at the idea that there are Jews in control of Hollywood and the media. And in fact, Daryl Larson specifically talks about this character as a potentially low-level anti-Semitic stereotype.
What do you think?
Well, I,
Just because I have an idea, it doesn't mean it's great. It could be lousy.
It could?
Yeah. What do you think?
I have a hard time with that characterization of Salzberg, potentially just because I have a hard time reconciling his cowboy hat and his weird fake American accent with the stereotype of a Jewish Hollywood mogul. In fact, I would go so far as to say they were attempting to have their cake and eat it too by having a name that seems to be a combination of Harry Saltzman and Irving Thalberg, two legendary producers, one from the 1930s and one from the 50s and 60s, squished together. That one might assume that therefore that's a Jewish stereotype, but they then swerve so far away with that by Graham's performance that I really disagree with that characterization.
Hmm.
In case you don't know who Irving Thalberg and Henry Saltzman are, Thalberg was an astonishingly powerful producer in the 60s. He was one of the partners with the Broccolis and controlled the rights to James Bond, which I mentioned for two reasons. One, because the James Bond theme is actually used in this episode. It's used as the introduction to the mobsters who don't want to commit any crime.
All clear?
All clear, boss.
Right. This is the plan, then.
You have a tiny segment of John Barry's theme as the dun-dun-dun before they cut in to ramp up the tension and create action before a bunch of people who then refuse to break the law. It's a nice contrast, but fascinating that in 1969, five James Bond movies have come out. The most recent being You Only Live Twice came out in 1967, a movie which was rated number 2 in the all James Bond films in one magazine, I believe Entertainment Weekly, and rated number 4 on IGN, despite having an astonishing sequence wherein Sean Connery dresses up as a Japanese man with yellow face and haircut. So 2 years before this episode came out, one of the most financially successful James Bond movies. It had a overall worldwide gross of, let's see if I have this correct, $841 million adjusted for inflation in 2018. Number 6 in international gross of all the James Bond movies in 2011. Nobody seemed in mind, really, the fact that therefore there was this pretty astonishing racial makeup job in the middle of the movie, which then brings us back to the Indians in the lobby and the fact that we have two racial sideshows in this particular episode. A very brief one with a man in blackface throwing a spear at the neighbor of the city stockbroker. Mm-hmm. And then the more prominent centerpiece of Eric Idle playing a Sioux Indian.
Yeah, I have seen Eric Idle and John Cleese live a number of times, and I have not had the chance to write a question down.
And ask you just quickly,
do you meet any Monty Python fans that are Native Americans, African Americans, or Asian Americans? And if you do, does this come up? I would like to see them answer that question because they probably have thought about it.
One hopes. That is, you know, part of the current climate wherein, as we record this, a person has been invited and then rather publicly uninvited to join the SNL cast based on some racist comments that were made in his Twitter account and on podcasts. And the kind of way in which you phrase working through racial concepts for comedic effect and how you talk about what you were doing, why you were doing it, and whether you regret it has affected people's careers. Sarah Silverman has gone on to say that a blackface sketch she did on the Sarah Silverman program, which she did specifically in order to make fun of people who thought that blackface was acceptable, has affected her ability to get jobs subsequently. Even doing it in a satirical way still creates a visual that people can take out of context and say, Sarah Silverman thought doing blackface was funny. I think I have this understanding of these issues correct. If I'm not, please correct us on social media. There is a sense that how you talk about what you felt, more than just saying, well, everybody did it at the time in 1969, is important. And I, too, would be curious to hear whether the Pythons are unreconstructed about this or whether they have changed with the times and now would sort of shake their heads and go, good God, would I never do that again?
So one thing I learned when going to these events, it's usually Idle and Cleese just because they live in California. They used to go show some funny bits, then talk about their history, and then answer questions from the audience. Mm-hmm. But they have since stopped doing that because people just ask them the same questions, and they felt that people would ask a little bit more interesting, perhaps more candid questions if they had a chance to write them down, hand them to an usher, and then have them delivered to the stage.
Interesting.
So this is what happened at the last one I was at. Unfortunately, I got there just as it was starting and didn't realize this until it was too late, so...
I'm going to go and say that this particular sketch of...
The theater sketch.
As it's called, as opposed to the Red Indian sketch. There is a sense that the joke is not that he is a savage in an artistic realm. The joke is that Graham Chapman's character assumes that he's out of place, but in fact, the whole tribe are warriors and actors, are quite cultured, very good, and have a breadth of experience both acting and attending theatrical events and have quite high standards. And then it's funny because he's delivering it in bad 1950s cowboy movie dialogue. For a given degree of, quote, funny, unquote. I mean, that's the humorous intent behind the sketch. I don't at all claim that it holds up. But it is interesting that, therefore, part of the sketch is developed around the idea of it. It is based on a reversal of the audience's expectations, with Graham's character being an audience surrogate, where he's supposed to recognize that he's making the mistake in assuming that this is a savage instead of a cultured individual. The fact that he's still wearing body paint and a braided black wig and feathers and woo-woo Indian stereotype garb is a problem. And I don't defend that at all. But I think that it, unless I'm wrong, I do think that the point of the sketch is to say, stop underestimating people from, quote, primitive cultures. Unless that's the joke and therefore, haha, the primitive cultures can be artistically educated, and that's a shallow enough concept, and therefore I shouldn't be laughing at that. That's a strong possibility too. I will also point out, though, that's a very small idea. The sketch is a little overlong. They make the point, they drive it home, they then continue to stand in the driveway with the engine running and say, maybe I can drive a little bit further into the living room with this. It's not a long concept, but it's a rather lengthy sketch. And they could have cut into either more extravagant or interesting territory more quickly. The way that it wraps up with the Indian attack on the compere, who comes out and says that,
ladies and gentlemen, before the play starts, I would like to apologize to you all, but unfortunately, Miss Cicely Courtney is unable to appear owing to...
is a kind of escalation that I actually don't think it's necessarily a successful ending to the sketch, but at the same time, it's the kind of thing that perhaps should have happened earlier instead of the entirety of the sketch being based on, haha, classic American Western dialogue sure is funny, isn't it?
One thing Eric Idle's character does mention is he mentioned the director Sandy Kemp.
Yes!
Who is the same name as the actor who Eric Idle himself plays.
Yes, the previous episode. But yes, it's one more of the frequent references in this episode to other episodes and to itself. Because as we mentioned, the box of chocolates gets passed to Eric Idle's Native American character, at which point he then comments on how much he enjoys a good crunchy frog.
Crunchy frog, eat good.
So we have references within this episode to previous episodes, to distant past episodes. We have presages of future episodes, and we have references within the episode to itself. It's a very connected spider in the center of its web piece of continuity heavy for an episode that may or may not be anyone's particular favorite. However, I'm going to move us on a little bit, having mentioned Crunchy Frog. Nate, I have a strong suspicion that this might be one of your top three.
Am I right in thinking there's a real frog in here?
I'm going to have to disappoint you there.
Oh!
Basically because I had the disservice of seeing this sketch first on the Live at the Hollywood Bowl, which, to my mind, is a far better performance, far better execution.
And lovingly frosted with glucose.
With not that much changing of the words.
Okay, then tell me what did come in as one of your top three sense that this, I will only point out that this is, I think, our second appearance of a truly iconic sketch after Nudge Nudge. And I think that it's very important that you mentioned
crunchy, raw, unbound, real, dead frog.
The Live at the Hollywood Bowl performance. I think one of the reasons why this and Nudge Nudge have gone on to become sort of top 10 Python sketches is because of the way in which they become heightened in the live performance in terms of their energy and their internal drama.
If we took the bones out, it wouldn't be crunchy, would it?
And that they didn't they weren't necessarily amazing sketches in the original broadcast, but they went on to become party favorites because of the live shows, and therefore sort of everyone's favorite sketch. This is definitely one of those, and it needs to be mentioned because of that, because when people think of Python, a lot of them think of Crunchy Frog. So it is interesting to see it in a subtler and in potentially lower energy form here. So what is a sketch that was successful for you in this format?
The Dull Life of a City Stockbroker.
Which we've talked a fair amount about. What about it appeals to you?
I just like how weird it is. Everything that he goes through is so bizarre and so different. Starting off by missing a spear being hucked at him and not really even clocking that, to nearly being killed by Frankenstein's monster without really knowing that, nearly getting blown up by a grenade, picking up his news by a bare-breasted woman that he doesn't even look twice. I think he sees her, doesn't even acknowledge that. And the only thing that causes him to be a little bit scandalous is this stupid little comic book. Even that it's not the funny part. The funny part to me is just like how weird it gets.
I always forget about the Frankenstein's monster appearance. I remember the philandering wife. I remember the office full of weird bodies and people in different positions. I vaguely remember the fact that his bus gets attacked by the military, but I always forget that John Cleese is literally dressed up in green with bolts coming out of his neck and just clobbering a line of people waiting for the bus. And then he snaps his fingers with an aw shucks that he doesn't get to kill Palin's character. It's a very strange piece of pop culture that they just stick in there. And you're right, it doesn't connect to anything around it. It doesn't connect to the invisible robot car. It doesn't connect to the spear chucking neighbor killer. It doesn't, it's a complete non sequitur, and it always surprises me.
Number two we've also talked about is
a Scotsman on a horse.
Now I've been thinking a while, like, why do I like this one? And I think I'm a little bit biased. The fact that I really enjoy Baroque music, and the music that is played is something called Bonnie Sweet Robin, which is an English popular piece around the time of the Renaissance, probably mid-1600s, originally written for the lute, but this particular recording was done on harpsichord by a lady named Zuzana Ruzikova, who passed away just a couple of years ago, from a 1966 recording called Harpsichord Music from England, Spain, and Portugal. Now, none of this is really important to the episode, but I really enjoy harpsichord music and I love Baroque music. So I think that is what got me to pay attention a little bit more. That I just love how serious it's played. It's played like some dramatic period piece.
I think one of the ways in which it constructs that drama is the use of the music and the way in which the music is there for the church scenes and then cuts away for the riding sequences. So you have totally different soundscape from silent and then in the church with the commotion and motion, and then it creates a very dramatic back and forth and heightening, because it's all of one soundscape and all of another and cutting back and forth. It's an extremely well-edited sequence. Potentially one of the reasons why it took so long for it to go from recorded to broadcast, that maybe they were tweaking it, maybe they were working on it for such a long time, because it's really well done. And I think that you're responding to it on an emotional and a visceral level because of the production, the work that went into it. And some of that is the soundtrack.
In a typical Python fashion, once it's revealed that the Scotsman on the horse is there to pick up Michael Palin, the young boy, as opposed to the young woman, you only have 2.5 seconds before it cuts to the stock footage of women clapping. So in typical Python fashion, they don't really give themselves a victory lap. It cuts the punchline right away. It doesn't really have a chance to be self-serving or overplayed. But you're right. It's definitely the editing and the filming and the care that was taken with the costuming and the music. I really like that one for those reasons.
And while they do cut away and move out of that into an animation very quickly, it is what I clocked at least as one of the three loudest laughs of the episode. I think the audience appreciates the reversal. I think they also got sucked into the drama and then were pleased and surprised at the shift at the end. The third loudest laugh happens in the transition just after this animation, where you have the pram that's grabbing various men, because once the Scotsman picks up his young man and walks off with it, it then cuts to a fairly camp animated gentleman who says,
"Oh, I like that. I want to get one of those for myself too, Peachy."
At which point, the pram then drives around the countryside grabbing men and eating them up in sort of a odd combination of sexual energy and consumption. At which point, the pram is then shown on with a police spotlight and has a 16-ton weight dropped on it. That spotlight then turns into one of the spotlights from the 20th Century Vole mock-up of the 20th Century Fox logo. And when the audience recognizes both that and then cuts to a vole in the MGM lion logo, they laugh like crazy. They're like, "Oh, I recognize that, and it's not a lion. It's a dumb, squeaky animal." They think that's just the bee's knees.
Oddly enough, number three, 20th Century Vole. I think actually this is my favorite sketch of the episode.
It's a weird sketch, Nathan. It's a very, very strange sketch.
"Oh, boys, I want you to know that I think you're the best six writers in movies today."
I think it has a lot of really good things that work in it, but I'm curious as to what about it specifically appeals to you.
Well, first off, it's a supreme performance by Graham Chapman. What I love about this sketch most is that the humor of it comes from these six yes men navigating the whims of this, like, over-the-top tyrannical Hollywood film producer.
"Yo!"
And they're trying to strike a balance of, like, what is being too yes man-y, what is not being too critical.
Well, I think it's an excellent idea.
"Are you a yes man?"
No. I mean, there may be things against it.
"You think it's lousy, huh?"
No. It takes time.
Without being indecisive, and they sort of, like, one by one, they're knocked off.
"Get out! Huh? If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a yes man. Get out! Woo-hoo! I'll see you never work again!"
By swinging too far to one extreme and then the other, the back and forth of just testing. You start off with Terry Gilliam, who says,
"Sir, I don't know how to say this, but I've got to be perfectly frank.
This film of yours is the most impactful in all of Hollywood history." Well, that's clearly too obsequious, and he gets knocked off first, and then he asks Ian Davis, he said, "What do you think?" It's like, "Well,
it's lousy."
"Well, you see, he spoke his mind. He said, my idea was lousy. Just so happens my idea isn't lousy, so get out, you've
got to..." Turns out it's not lousy. So this back and forth of it being too much, I just find that really funny. And also, all the pythons are in it. You have Terry Gilliam with his first big moment.
Yeah, outside of a suit of armor. I love Gilliam's performance in that. It really is basically just the one line, but I find it fascinating that he's so good at doing a fake American accent, because his slimy yes man accent is very clearly a fake, over the top, gooey piece of nonsense. And yet it makes me laugh just the way in which he slimes into it. He's very funny doing that, and his little mustache is disgusting and hilarious. I think he's great.
Right at the end, as Chapman is like on the table on all fours, he mentions David Lemming, which is I guess, animalization of David Hemmings.
Okay.
Who's actually an actor he mentioned already in the sketch. Just to give you an idea, I don't know, because I don't have the script, if Chapman was just losing words or if he actually did speak the way the words were written, because he mentions Doris Day, Rock Hudson, become Doris Dog and Rock Tree. And David Lemming, who is actually David Hemmings. People might remember him from Gladiator as Cassius, the loudspeaker man. But it's a great performance. And I think that photo of his right at the top, it's so big. I can't imagine how long it took for them to make it. But I just love that picture.
I've always associated it with the giant photo that's the primary image of Citizen Kane, character that of Orson Welles standing in front of his own campaign photo as he tries to Okay, I'll be honest. I fell asleep during Citizen Kane. I don't know what he does. Charles Foster Kane does a thing. I don't know what it is. I apologize, everyone. But the image is iconic. And I did look it up to try and see whether I felt like it was a deliberate one-to-one homage. The faces are different, the angle's different, and yet to me, it still has that classic film mogul power thing built into it that makes me feel like that's still the most obvious prominent reference, and I do feel like it has to be a shout out to that, even if it's not a direct visual one-to-one miming of the original shot. Yes, it's come to that time in the podcast where we do the Monty Python Minute. We're using the random number generator at random.org, non-spawn. We pick a minute from the episode, put in 1 to 28, and see where the dial falls. Nathan then watches that minute, and then he has 30 seconds to summarize what happens in that minute, and then he has a minute after that to answer a series of random questions and challenges that I pose to him. And today is going to be a doozy, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Nate, speaking about editing things out, this may go spectacularly wrong because I've based it on something that you used to be able to do but may not be able to do anymore. If it fails, it fails, and that's on me. We'll figure out what... If it goes spectacularly wrong, I have a very badly organized backup plan.
Okay. All right, what's it going to be?
So, the genie web wizards at random.org have come up with minute number two. That's minute number two.
Mendelssohn and Bach. Names that will live forever. But there is one composer whose name is never in...
Joy.
Hey, I'm just pleased that it hadn't come up in our conversation previously.
Yeah.
It was just a random coincidence that it didn't work out that way. I was convinced it was going to be in your top three. And then when it wasn't, I was like, oh, lucky. We won't have already tread on this territory previously.
I have reasons for things.
Nathan has watched the minute. He now has 30 seconds to summarize it. And those 30 seconds start now.
The man's name is Johann Gembelpotti, Devon Auspern, Splendid Setter Kress, Cranbond, Fire, Digger Dagger, Donker, Dugger, Burstein, Von Nackathasher, Applebengel, Horowitz, Tickle, Linsing, Granite, Notch, Spell, Tinkle, Grand Lecker, Meyer, Swatter, Wasser, Kurslack, Emeline, Beinwagen, Guten Abend, Biedenheit, Nürnberger, Brat, Russell, Westwirten, Dicke, Weinbach, Luberon, Swatter, Gunner, Robert, Schoenerdor, Kaufschoss, Mittelrocker, Von Halfcraft of Ulm. Whew. It's a very long name that, amazingly, Graham Chapman is able to get out twice in one take. And he does it with a slightly Germanized accent, and it is really hilarious.
Stop,
and
the audience... I'm sorry, I got distracted by enjoying your recitation so much. I stopped paying attention to this time. I didn't give you a 10-second warning or a 5-second warning. I was just flabbergasted.
Yeah, that's okay.
Oh,
I do love this performance of Chapman. Again, knowing that he was suffering from alcoholism in this part of his life, getting through... this name twice.
Of Johann Gembelpotti, Devon Auspern, Splendenschlitt, Kress Krenbon, Friediger Dangle Dungle Barstein von Neckthresher Applebanger, Horowitz Tickolensic, Grander Noddy Speltickle,
is Grandish, really impressive. That also contrasts with the fact that Cleese gets the name wrong. In fact, on film, he drops a name. It might be the case that Graham Chapman drops one of the dingle dangle dongle dungles. I can't tell. It's kind of spoken really quickly. But you can clearly hear that Cleese does not say one of the names. I'm going to forget which one it is. But that's on film. And it's not like they changed the name from the 6 months between filming and studio, because Terry Jones is right there. And he does say that the name that Cleese drops twice.
The name is said six times over the course of the sketch, twice by Chapman, once by Jones, two times by John Cleese, and then once in a combination between a various number of Vikings and bankers and professors and animated characters and Graham. And then there are two times in which the name is started to say and then abandoned. So it comes in at a little over... six times over the course of the sketch. It takes Graham 20 seconds to say it, the two times that he says it in full. You, in your recitation in the 30 seconds, came in at 19 and change, really burning through it. My challenge for you was going to be, since the number was 2, to be able to recite it twice in 1 minute. But there's no way you wouldn't be able to do that. You've totally stumped me because you used it in your recitation. You had it down cold. I'm very impressed. I have in front of me the breakdown of the name. It takes up an entire sheet of legal size paper if you turn each word or phrase into its own line so that you can try and work through von Ausfern, Spendlin, Schlitter, Dingle Dangle Dongle Dongle, Burstein, von Nagerthrasher, Applebagger, or like each line you do break it down as a memorizable moment. It fills an entire page. So I just have a couple of things for you. I translated some of them. Some of it with the help of Larson, some of it with my own very weak knowledge of German. Let's just try one or two of these and see if you know what they might mean. And if you can get two of them right, then you'll have won our Monty Python Minute Quiz.
What they mean in English, you mean?
Correct.
Oh, God.
Okay. So, what does gamble putty mean?
Gamble putty is, of course, the Middle Germanic tribe name, meaning one who antes just a little bit after the hand is dealt. So they're always dealt a little bit of grief for anteing late. So gamble. I have no idea what it means.
gamble means to leap or frolic. And putty is a cock-like adhesive.
So putty is putty.
Yes. Yes. All right. What else do I have here? Knocker thrasher and apple banger are both synonyms for what kind of emasculating phrase in English?
Apple banger, necker thrasher, emasculating, is it like dickhead?
Closer. That's more out cough at the very end. Cough is head. Think more English. What's the, a knacker or an apple are both, what shape?
Spheroid.
And so if you're,
ball basher?
Correct.
Ball banger.
Yes, ball buster. Congratulations. Tico lens is not related to Costa Rica, where people are referred to as Tico. But Tico lens is a field in medical science. So if something is ticolensic, what does it refer to?
Ticolensic is the rheumatoid arthritis one gets, or gout.
Unfortunately, it's oral microbiology.
Tooth decay?
Very good. What greeting is hidden in the name?
Guten Abend.
Which translates as?
Good morning.
Unfortunately, that's good. Guten Morgen is good morning. Guten Abend is therefore...
Good evening.
Very good. Guten Abend, bitter. Good evening.
Good night. Ding, 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 ding.
I've got a couple more in here. Grandlich is ironic because leek means little, close to liebe. And so later after Grandlich, you have Kirstlich, which means shortly and little. But Grandlich is therefore interestingly weird. It's both big and little, sort of a little John in the middle of that. And then we have Svelterwasser, which is, Wasser is water, and Svelter is a zinc that's used in soldering, or soldering if you're in England. And so therefore, it's the second reference to zinc in the episode, in addition to the zinc stoat that starts us off.
Oh, interesting. I do have that Cleese drops Horowitz.
Okay, yes.
Twice.
And do you know who Vladimir Horowitz is?
Vladimir Horowitz, he's a pianist.
Correct. And in 1969, he had retired. He had just announced that he was no longer playing and continued to not play until the mid-70s. And so he, just before this sketch was written, probably, had ceased to be a public figure for a period of time.
Hmm.
Well, I think you have very readily met that challenge, so congratulations on utterly destroying the Monty Python Minute. We'll have to come up with something a little bit harder next time.
All right, now we have come to the part of the show where we touch on our 5 top moments from Monty Python's Flying Circus. It's the arts. So the moment, as you remember, is a brief bit of film or taped studio acting or simple joke, which is a very brief, is not necessarily a full sketch, just something that makes us smile. It gives us a chuckle. So Ben, give me a top 5 moment.
John Cleese standing up, walking off camera, and coming back with a shovel to dig the grave for Terry Jones' character. It's a long, silent pause, and it's a strange reaction to a man dying. Not, let's call an ambulance, let's get a doctor. It's, we're going to bury him in this field where we're being interviewed, and we're going to destroy this footage later. I don't know. It's a strange little moment. But I also like the length of it, the quiet of it. It's a small kind of acting to just be in serious character of, now I have to get rid of this body. But at the same time, he doesn't break. He carries the full weight of it. Cleese does some pretty good acting in a number of different bits in this episode. He's curiously weird as the I have no lines mobster in the mob that commits no crime sketch later. He, in fact, I think turns in one of his worst performances ever in that sketch. It's almost like he doesn't understand where the camera is in relationship to his performance. But in this, I really love what he does. And that's why I'm gonna start with that in my five.
Okay. In the middle of the Vox Pops for burglary, we have Michael Palin dressed as a very nasty looking woman say,
I think sexual ecstasy is overrated.
With no rhyme or reason. But that makes me laugh every single time.
It's so good. It's so indicative of the... It. By the way, it was 100% on my list. It's so indicative of the kind of thing that happens in a Vox Pox moment, or that you could anticipate, that you go out there in the British public to get their opinions on something, and they just deviate. They just go where they want to go. It has nothing to do with the topic at hand, but whatever it has to do with their own particular preoccupations. That one is wild and woolly, and because it's such a huge swing from the sentences before that of Terry Jones robbing a poor box and John Cleese's weirdly buttoned down accountant character, it's a pretty great non sequitur. And if you can have a non sequitur vox populi, then you've got a lot of Latin.
Number three, what you got?
I'm going to say that there are a couple of great little strange moments in terms of sentences that are thrown out. And I like John Cleese's character as the police officer, as much as you thought he had strange energy for Crunchy Frog.
Next, we have number four. Crunchy Frog.
Ah, yes.
I like the way in which he's part of the Vox Pops and announces that he's going to be in a sketch later. I like the way he enters into the scene with his cheeky grin and his acknowledgement that...
Hello.
See, now I'm on set where I was just on film. And I like the way he ends the sketch by saying,
the BBC would like to apologize for the extremely poor quality of the next announcement.
It's one of the main reasons I fell in love with Monty Python was because of their deconstructive nature, because they comment about being on film, because they interrupt their own sketches, because they create their own non-linear continuity. Whenever they're breaking the walls, it makes me happy. And so, yes, for that policeman to apologize for what's going to happen in the future, that puts a nice little smile on my face.
Number four is a nod to Gilliam's talent as a animator.
Okay.
I don't know how to do animation. I mean, I kind of know in principle how it works, but how do you get a guy writing in Sharpie on a notepad, a word he's already written, come to life and form a little squiggle without having the vestiges of that mark still on the piece of paper suddenly become alive?
Could I have your autograph?
Certainly, yes.
Kind of understand, like, there's something that he's doing with, maybe he's got two pieces of paper, or maybe he just, like, filmed it in a certain order. I don't know. But it seems too smooth for such a simplistic take. It seems like there's something he's doing which I'm just not getting. I find that whole sequence just really delightful to watch and very well done, because you're mixing animation, so you have a moving thing on a piece of paper, and then you have a hand, which does look like it's moving and slapping down on the table. That takes some very fine coordination of camera and actor movement and little drawn bit movement. Technically, it's a very well executed animation, so I'm going to give that as my top moment. Number four. that fourth moment.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think the technical skill required to switch from fully animated, where you're shooting something with stop motion, where you're shooting at a frame at a time, to then actually have the hand be interacting with something in real time. There's some really good George Melies special effects going on in there. Also, of course, it's interacting in a 3D and a 2D level, where sometimes the squiggle is an animated thing and sometimes he's holding it in his hand. It's fascinating and really well done, and I'm glad you also picked up on it.
Yeah. Do you have a number five?
Yeah. I've been complimenting Cleese a lot in these bits, so I feel silly going back to that well, but... We didn't talk about his character in the 20th century Vole Irving C. Salzburg production board meeting, but I love his indecisive yes man.
Are you being indecisive?
Yo, Ness, perhaps. Oh.
It's a simple joke. And then he just gives up and runs away. Cleese doesn't play a lot of weak characters. He tends to play strong men who are secretly weak or weak men who are pretending to be strong. So for him to just play a spineless, indecisive jellyfish is fun. It's a nice little stretch for him. And it is nice to see the five of them all in a row with Ian Davidson and the cast and then... Irving himself weirdly disintegrating at the end of the table.
I can't take it anymore!
I like that! I can't take it anymore! And then Rock Hudson says, I'm a very rich film producer and I need a lobotomy. And then Doris Dodd says, I think you're very handsome and I'm going to take all my...
It's a fun group and each one of them has a personality and has a character and this written to their strengths as performers. But they all also doing things that aren't just... what they've always done in the past. It's a great sketch, and I think Cleese's moment in it is one of my favorites.
Roll the credits!
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emley. Sound design and editing by the two of us.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and was sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
If there are things, dates, names, facts, controversies, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect and needs to be set right, please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. If you feel like you can recite the entire name of Johann Gembelputty, etc., etc., please record yourself and send it to our webpage. We'll be happy to listen to it.
Get that baby up on TikTok, and we will play it and link to it.
I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Splunge!
We'll see you next time when we discuss Episode 7. You're no fun anymore.
I'm sorry.
He's got a great whimper.
I hope that's said about all of us at one time in our lives.
I love that.